Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another podcast. I'm Christina Vogt, Assistant Editor for Consultant360.com. Our guest for today's podcast is Dr. Robert Lehtman, who is an internal medicine physician at Bronx Westchester Medical Group in New York. He is also on the board of directors for the Schizophrenia and Related Disorders Alliance of America. Over the last 10 years, he has developed a practice taking care of people with psychotic disorders. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Lehtman.
A pleasure to be here.
Today, we will be talking about treatment options. So, Dr. Lehtman, what medications are considered first and second line treatments for schizophrenia? And why do you feel that clozapine should play a greater role in treating this condition?
The first line treatment, and really the only approach in terms of medical care, is to use the antipsychotic drugs. There are first generation, which are the neuroleptic medicines, which have been out, starting with Thorazine, since the 1950s. And these are drugs that primarily block dopamine, the D2 receptor. And that was the initial hypothesis of what was wrong with schizophrenia. It's a chemical imbalance. There is just too much dopamine. And these drugs worked incredibly well, especially for what we call the positive symptoms, the delusions, the hallucinations, but did very, very little for the negative symptoms. And they had a lot of side effects. And in fact, in some cases, it seemed to make the negative symptoms worse, in that some of the neuromuscular blockade would make the facial expression less, people would become very stiff and more detached from other individuals because it also affected some of their cognitive abilities. Then the first, second generation non-neuroleptic was clozapine. And this was actually synthesized by Wander Drugs, the makers of Ovaltine, in 1958. AstraZeneca took it over and eventually developed it in the 60s. Now, clozapine had seemingly very little, if any, effect on dopamine. So people were really quite puzzled that it was such an effective antipsychotic. And it has been, and it remains, the gold standard antipsychotic that's out there in terms of efficacy. At first, it really did not catch on in the 60s because of the neuroleptic hypothesis that it was dopamine. And yet, people did exceedingly well. There was well over 600 individuals by 1966 that were being treated with this in Europe. And things were really picking up with clozapine. Then all of a sudden, in 1975, the famed Finnish epidemic occurred, where 8 infirm women in a small Finnish town that were all on clozapine and a variety of other antipsychotics developed agranulocytosis, which is a very, very low white count, a white count less than 500. And of these people, several of them succumbed. They died. And at that point, clozapine was withdrawn from the markets in the United States and continued to be used sparingly only in Europe. Under further investigation over the years, it was redetermined that clozapine was not necessarily responsible for the deaths of these individuals. However, the fear of clozapine was firmly entrenched in the psychiatric community. As it turns out, the risk of developing this feared complication is about 3 in 10,000 individuals. Of those, the estimated risk of death in a variety of the basic groups that have been following people on clozapine lists from 0% to 1 in 20. So the risk of death at the highest using clozapine is 1 in 10,000. Nevertheless, it stayed off the market and people thought they could take clozapine molecule and develop a clozapine that's even safer. And so all the other second generation antipsychotics were derived off of clozapine and started with Risperdal, and it's continued on, and now there are 12 other antipsychotic drugs out there. The problem is that all of these other antipsychotics, though somewhat effective when compared to clozapine, are not as effective in any setting in which they've been measured. In 1990, clozapine was reintroduced into the United States, and it was reintroduced as a new drug indication. And that was for resistant schizophrenia. And how we define that is patients that have failed three other antipsychotics in two different classes, given adequate trials. The reality is we're missing the boat, because in the United States, clozapine, which should be used conservatively, this is by Herb Meltzer, one of the people that brought it to the United States, in a minimum of 40%, I think more like 70, 80, 90, maybe closer to 100%, is used in only 2% of all individuals that get treatment, and 50% of all individuals get treatment. So we're talking about 1% of our population. A huge push presently in New York State Office of Mental Health is to use more clozapine, and that is also a huge push with SAMHSA.
What other non-pharmacologic components should be included in the treatment plan?
Other non-pharmacologic components also have to be considered early. A very important trial that came out called EPIC in 1999 was done in Australia, and what this was taking early psychosis patients in the first year and a half of psychosis, and giving them full wraparound services, vocational training, education, clinical support, doing cognitive behavioral therapy, believe it or not, befriending the individual. Actually incredibly useful when effective antipsychotics were used. This is 1999. Of course, in Australia, their population, 40% of the individuals are on clozapine. Now, come to the United States. In 2016, we did the RAISE project, which is essentially the EPIC project that was done in Australia in 1999. And lo and behold, we found the same results, that if you treat someone early and you give them wraparound services and you give them enough social support, they can do quite well. The other thing that's been nice about the RAISE trial is that if someone is not doing clinically well, they will only go through two medicines and then they'll quickly switch over to clozapine.
What other factors of treatment are important for physicians treating schizophrenia to take into account?
Outside of the antipsychotics, also what we've realized is that if we're going to use these drugs, we have to start to pay attention to the side effects. And that is going to be something that is critically important. And that's what I, as an internist, I stress right from the get-go. A lot of these drugs not only have a lot of sedation, but they can cause a lot of weight gain, and they have a variety of other side effects. I spend a great deal of my time coming up with regimens, because there's really nothing easy in this approach. But having said that, what we're starting to realize is that if we take a global approach and we treat people early with the most effective antipsychotic, which is clozapine, which is the approach I take, and you provide them with all the tools that they need, you can change the trajectory of the illness. A huge change in schizophrenia is the change in the idea of recovery. In the United States, up until very recently, the first 5 years of illness, meaningful recovery only occurs in about 10%. In my experience now, and I've taken care of well over 100 patients, I have close to 70, 80% in meaningful recovery. What do I do differently? I've taken what RAISE has done and used clozapine, and I involve these kids in therapy. You can use cognitive behavioral therapy. As I said, you befriend them. You become available to them. It's a tremendous amount of work, but these kids go and have meaningful lives. This is something that can be done, needs to be done, but it's a tremendous amount of work.
Are there any new treatment options currently on the horizon?
What we need to take is the best form of therapy, and we have to develop a long-acting formulation that is deliverable so that the patient who may not take an oral medicine will take it, you know, be it an injection or an implantable device, something. And those are hopefully therapies that are on the horizon. Things that are also being considered as adjunct therapies and are being actively explored are some of the older therapies that are out there, including electroconvulsive therapy.
How important is addressing the stigma associated with schizophrenia when it comes to treating this condition?
It all starts with getting rid of the stigma. And when I talk about getting rid of the stigma, I'm not talking about the stigma in the community. I'm talking about the stigma in the psychiatric community and the self-stigma. Again, you have to start by changing what people believe can happen. The whole belief system of the psychiatric community is we're going to try to keep your son or daughter out of the hospital. They're not going to have a life. Their life is over. They won't go to school. They won't work. Let's put your son or daughter on disability. And let's just hope for the best. And we're going to treat with these really potent antipsychotics. That's not enough. People have to realize that if you are very aggressive and you treat really early, you can absolutely change the trajectory of the illness. I want to make people aware of an effort by Schizophrenia and Related Disorders Alliance of America, SARDA. We are trying to reclassify schizophrenia, moving it from the mental illness field into the neurology field, since schizophrenia is a neurodevelopmental syndrome. How that'll change things, it will allow people, I believe, to get a fuller treatment because there are some restrictions presently with the medical care that they can receive. And also, it'll help somewhat in the stigma, and it'll give people a better understanding that this is a neurologic process. Acceptance comes much easier when you tell someone they've got a seizure disorder or Alzheimer's. It's not pull yourself up by your bootstraps. This is a neurologic condition that needs medical treatment.
Thanks again for joining me today, Dr. Lehtman. Stay tuned for the next installment of our podcast series on schizophrenia.